this is the first, but we have every reason to think it won't be the last, of a series of forums on the First Lady. Several of you in this room have urged such discussions. James Scott Rosebush has made them possible. I thought in introducing the subject, I might just quote from a June 9th speech of Mrs. Reagan. A First Lady genuinely has the power to make a difference. And to make a difference is what all of us want in our lives. And in another passage, you live a magnified life, which means the highs are higher, the lows are lower, with every move you make exaggerated by the tremendous scrutiny of the media. It is a high-wire existence. And then for the Miller Center, a statement that the members of the commission that we had on presidential disability had strongly urged us to transmit to not only the media but also to Mrs. Reagan's present staff. As you know, there was a controversy about when Mr. Reagan should get on the road after the cancer surgery, and there is some discussion of that in a book which we're not advertising this morning. But in her speech she said, as a wife, I believe my husband has as much right to a normal recuperation as any other husband. And I think it's an important, legitimate role for a First Lady to look after a president's health and well-being. And if that interferes with affairs of state, then so be it. No First Lady need make apologies for looking out for her husband's personal welfare. This discussion is not on Mrs. Reagan, but her achievements highlight the importance of the office and our topic this morning. James Scott Rosebush, for 4 years, was chief of staff for the First Lady, Nancy Reagan, within the White House. Before that, he was the head of the Office of Business Liaison in the Department of Commerce and also special assistant to President Reagan for private sector initiatives, a program which he created and managed. Before that, he was vice president of the National Chamber Foundation in Washington and associate director for corporate contributions of Standard Oil Company in Cleveland. He's held many board and commission positions in the field of corporate contributions. He is the founder of his own James Rosebush and Company, a public affairs consulting firm. It's a great pleasure to have him with us this morning, in part because we have the Miller Center and Mr. Rosebush have the same publisher. And if at the end of the meeting you should be interested in his overall treatment of this discussion in a little more detail than is possible this morning, his Madison book, published by University Press of America, which normally retails for $24, $25, is available, and if...
At discount today.
At a discount of $20, and the biggest discount is that he also will autograph it. And so it's a real pleasure to have Jim Rosebush with us.
Thank you so much, Mr. What I want to know, is this a symbolic cup of cold water? Is this what you offer all your guests?
I think we better get that.
Yeah, you don't want to hear that.
Better. Either one or the other should be turned off.
It's especially nice to be with you today here at the Miller Center. In addition to its great reputation, it's an honor for me and a privilege for me to be here with you today. But there's several other reasons that I was particularly delighted with Mr. Thompson's invitation.
I think.
Okay.
I think that the problem may be between this and that.
It is.
Yeah.
Scott?
Somebody's coming.
Is it the air conditioning that's making the noise?
No, I think it's a feedback between these two.
You got a double feedback for that. Can we turn one of them off?
Okay, we'll try. I don't want your ears to go on tilt. But I just wanted to mention a number of the reasons that it's so attractive for me to accept this invitation to be with you here today. And one is that this is not an after-lunch speech. It's not really going to be a speech either, but I'm used to making speeches at lunch, and I'm used to seeing flowered hats with chins in their chest like this. There's something about speeches at lunch or after lunch that makes someone drowsy, despite the fact that I give a very thrilling speech, I can assure you. Also, that this is a little change for me in as much as it's not a women's club. I'm used to talking to lots of women's clubs across the country, which is not to denigrate their value, because I've been amazed at the power of intelligent women who are a part of women's clubs across this country. They ask very good questions, but they always, as much as I'm interested in educating them about and discussing the public policy aspects of the role of American First Ladies in political life, somehow the questions always creeping in at the end, well, now, is Nancy Reagan really a size 2? Does she really like red? And I'm happy to answer questions like that, and I'll be happy to answer your questions along those lines. But what I want to focus on today are really more of the public policy questions. There's an enormous amount of material to cover in the area of First Ladies and their contribution to American political life. And we're only going to be able to touch the surface today. We're not going to get into the biographical information with regard to First Ladies by and large, but we're going to touch on their contribution to our country and to its heritage. The third reason I'm especially happy to be here today is, as I mentioned to Mr. Thompson, I'd grab any opportunity to come and be near Jefferson's Academical Village, because it has a particular place of affection with me. And I was thinking last night in walking on the lawn, it was very quiet last night with all the students gone, about what kind of First Lady Mrs. Jefferson might have been had she lived, that raven-haired beauty, wife of Thomas Jefferson. But I remembered at the same time that it was Mr. Jefferson who said that the tender breasts of women were not formed for the convulsions of political life. And I thought, I asked myself whether that opinion would have applied to his wife as well. Because in fact, what we have to consider today, I think, by and large, has to do with the partnership of marriage and the role of women and the role of spouses as First Ladies in American political life, really has an awful lot to do with the marriage partnership and the fact that today, in particular, and this has been true to a certain extent throughout history, the job of being president is a dual, takes two people. It takes a team. And people who don't accept that or overlook that fact, then I think have problems really understanding just what the role of this supporting spouse is. And I think your comments, Mr. Thompson, drawn from Mrs. Reagan's recent speech, largely in defense of her position as First Lady, draws our attention to that fact that she has played this supporting role. And I'll get into that a little bit later. We're going to do three things here this morning. And I've already confessed to you that this is not going to be a speech. The morning is too warm for that, and we're too crowded in here. But what we're going to do is I'm going to give you, there are going to be three areas. The first is going to be a focus on just who these women have been, where they've come from, and more or less a statistical overview of this group of women, 36 women who've actually been wives of presidents who've served in this capacity. There are 51 women who've served in representational roles. Secondly, I'm going to get into a definition of the job, which is really what my interest has been in recent speeches and in this book. And thirdly, we're going to have a discussion of four questions that are timely today, and I'd like to hear your opinion on them. And just as your favorite professor in graduate school might have done, I'm going to tell you what those questions are now so that you can think about them while I'm covering this other material. First, how do you eclipse the power of a first lady? Second, should first ladies be salaried? Third, should public funds be used to support the office of first lady? Four, how can we stop trivializing the role of first ladies in American political life? Those are the four questions we're going to focus on in the third part of our discussion here today. And I truly look upon this as a discussion, particularly during this latter period. So I hope that you'll be ready with your questions and comments. First of all, we know today that our First Lady is not elected. She's not paid. There's no constitutional authority for the job of First Lady. She's not in line of succession to become president, although she probably knows more about the development of any public policy during her husband's term than any staff or anyone who might be in line of succession. She can't be impeached. The question is she a hostess? Is she a confidant? Is she a public official? Most of these women have come to the job with little preparation, with little experience. They've lost all their privacy. Many of them are shell-shocked. Some of the early first ladies wrote about how they were sick of public life. They were afraid of the expenses of the presidency desecrating their personal treasuries. They were afraid of exposure to the media. Even though in early times it wasn't anything like it is today. Who are these women? Their average age was 47. The majority of them were Episcopalian. More of them were born in New York State than any other state for some reason. We don't know exactly why. Sorry to say they weren't from Virginia. Most of them. 51 women have served. 36 of them have been wives. Four different women served for John Tyler, for example. Five were married to men who became president prior. They were married to them prior to their becoming president. Six couples were childless: the Washingtons, the Madisons, Jacksons, Polks, Wilsons, and Hardings. No one knows exactly where the title of First Lady actually came from, but we do know at the inauguration of Rutherford B. Hayes in 1877, the reporter Lucy Clemmer Ames used the term "Our First Lady of the Nation" to describe Lucy Hayes at the inauguration. You know that it was Jacqueline Kennedy, for example, who thought that she refused to be called First Lady because she thought it sounded more like a racehorse. And I can't say that I disagree with her. Early first ladies were called Your Highness, Lady Presidentress, Your Royalty, Your Serene Highness. There was a lot of confusion about what to call this woman who was married to the President of the United States. You had to recall, I mean, we were just in very early pioneer stages of developing our forms of government and protocol as we know them today. So, to summarize, there's no constitutional authority for this job as it's become, unlike that of the job of being president, for which we have constitutional authority, legal precedent, and historical precedent. But what do we want in first ladies, and what do we want in this job? To a large extent, first ladies have been models of the changing role of women in society. If you take this group of women as a whole, you will see, however, that most of them have been followers and played supporting roles rather than women in history that you might think of who have been pioneers. So these women have largely followed the changing role of women in society. This has been particularly, you can see this as particularly true around the turn of the century when more women were pursuing university educations, more women were involved, and it became acceptable for women to become involved in community social work, for example, Hull House in Chicago, as it was more accepted for women to become involved in a cause or to volunteer in the community in some form of social good. You see this reflected then in the role of first ladies. For example, the first Mrs. Wilson, Ellen Wilson, had her cause, which was slum clearance in Washington in those back alleys around DuPont Circle, actually become a piece of federal legislation. She was involved in a movement of some social achievement that led to a piece of federal legislation. I contend that that was largely because of the evolving role of women in the area of social work. Few of them then pioneered their role, except a handful of first ladies, such as Dolly Madison, who was an early pioneer of the job of first lady, and of course Eleanor Roosevelt, who struck out on her own for her own particular reasons, the reason of the largely a function of the times, of her marriage, and of her own personal inclinations to get involved in causes that she felt personally attracted to. So she was an exception, and I think we all know that. Do Americans want a partner in their first lady or first spouse? There's some interesting facts about this. During the time of Mrs. Reagan's rise in popularity, which occurred largely in 1982 and 1983, at the end of 1983, we took a poll to determine precisely why her standing had increased from a very low level, you remember, in 1981, to a higher level in 1983. And we had some surprising results, because what you read in the media would lead you to believe that the American people want a woman of independence, a woman who's outspoken and opinionated, and yet there are limits to that, which we'll talk about. The reason that Mrs. Reagan's popularity gained, according to this poll, was the fact that she was consistent in supporting her husband. And secondly, because she was involved in a cause of such enormous proportions as drug abuse, which affects one out of every three households in this country. So the two reasons for her rise in popularity gave me reason to believe that there's a very traditional thread of popular support in this country for a very traditional role for First Lady, and that is a supporting spouse or a supporting role. Most First Ladies, most of these women, have picked up on what I would call popular trends in society. For example, during the war, of course, Mary Lincoln went into the battlefield. Sarah Polk brought gas lights into the White House. Carolyn Harrison, electricity. Edith Wilson worked for World War I relief. Most of these women sold war bonds when it was required. Lucy Hayes banned liquor during that time in the White House. And Betty Ford expressed her interest in these social trends through her interview with Maury Schaefer, which was the beginning of her discussions about living together, social relations, and all this sort of thing. Most Americans say that they want someone who's not too outspoken. We encountered this in our own administration at the time of, you may remember when Nancy Reagan suggested to the president at the ranch, finished his sentence for him. I'm sure you all remember that sort of under her breath. The media went wild with that because they felt that she was prompting him. She was telling him what to say, and they found that unacceptable. And in fact, I think probably a large cross-section of Americans found it unacceptable as well, although it was a very natural, instinctive thing to do. At the time, in the aftermath of Don Regan's departure from the White House, the responsibility for his departure was laid to Nancy Reagan's door, though in fact, and I often point out to people that there were thousands of people across this country, including very influential people in policy positions and in the media, calling for Don Regan's resignation. There's a very curious thing that happens to a first lady. Everything gets laid to her blame. If it's something that that goes wrong in the White House or in her husband's political administration, then it's laid to the first lady's door. And there are hundreds of examples of this I've seen in my own life. I remember one day, to give you a small trivial example, I was walking between the residence, the White House residence in the West Wing, and I saw them moving a platform and so forth out of the Rose Garden into a room inside, and I said, "What are you doing?" They said, "Well, we have a group of sumo wrestlers coming in today to give a demonstration in the Rose Garden, and Nancy Reagan insists that those sumo wrestlers get moved out of the Rose Garden." And by this time, I was rather suspicious, because you might walk through a room like this and find it a little warm or the air conditioning blasting, and you say, "Well, why is it so warm in here?" The First Lady wants it that way. So I had become accustomed to hearing this, and I picked up the telephone, and I called her. I said, "Did you want these sumo wrestlers moved out of the room?" She said, "I didn't even know there were sumo wrestlers coming to the White House today." So people are always, I'm giving you some examples of things that we see throughout history. It's very easy. The first ladies have always been the scapegoats. The first ladies have always been the people who have been the first ones to blame for anything going wrong in the White House. You remember, for example, the trips of Rosalynn Carter to Latin America. We'll talk a little bit more about this role in a few minutes, but she was went there as a representative of her husband and was blasted by the Latin American press and by the leaders themselves because they didn't want to deal with a president's wife. They felt that they'd somehow been cheated out of dealing with the president. And yet, we have today, and people ask me, what kind of first lady we're going to have in the future, what kind of first spouse we're going to have in the future. And it's very possible that although the public today has been demanding more activism, more independence, and more visibility of first ladies, that if a woman were to come along in the mode of a Bess Truman or a Mamie Eisenhower, let's look back at Eleanor Roosevelt's example, for example. Here was a woman who was had tremendous visibility, tremendous independence, traveled the world, wrote a column, spoke to the media for the first time on the record. I mean, first ladies had never done this before. And yet, who followed her? A woman who was entirely caught up in her own family and home and was entirely out of the public eye, though she attended some official functions. I mean, she decided what kind of life she wanted to have with her own family. And I think today, a woman could come along in the Bess Truman, Mamie Eisenhower mode and be successful if she were sincere, candid, and forthright with the media and explaining exactly what she wanted to do and what she was going to do. For example, if you had a younger woman come along with young children, if she stood up in front of the TV cameras and said, "Don't expect me to be a crusading first lady. I'm going to stay at home." I think if she were upfront, candid, and forthright with the media, I think she could be successful. But these are all things we have to consider, especially now as we think of the future in this presidential election year. What do we want in our first ladies then? I think that we want to idealize our first ladies, but we don't want them to idealize themselves. We want a first lady who's comfortable in blue jeans or in a Jimmy Galanos gown. We want a first lady who works on causes but can entertain impeccably. We want a first lady who can travel elegantly but with no money. We want someone who can take care of the White House but not to be absorbed in it. And just to summarize this section, I'm going to read a short paragraph from my book because I think this summarizes the point I'm trying to make. "Any first lady must be, according to public dictates, attentive and interested in anyone, farmers, factory workers, and kings, but not too familiar. She must be well informed about her husband's political agendas, regardless of her interest in them. She's expected to reflect the spirit of America, the whole country, without regard to her own regional background. She must treat the press without contempt, even though they can treat her with it. Be well-dressed, not overdressed. Be prepared, but not rehearsed. Be a devoted wife, but also a woman of independence. Express opinions frankly, but never be flippant. Care for the house, but never appear too absorbed in it. Show emotion, but never appear contrived. Is there any wonder why Margaret Truman once called the position of First Lady the second hardest job in America? So how many of you want to run for First Lady? People ask me, you know, well, what do we expect in our First Ladies? And I always answer very quickly in one word, perfection. And this is where we get into trouble. We expect perfection in our presidents and our First Ladies. And we look so closely today at them. We look at whether they drop their right shoe, their hair color, what they're wearing, what they're saying, where they're going, who they're talking to, who they're associating with. Every nuance of their life, that we're bound to be dissatisfied, because you cannot find perfection in a human being. Okay, in this next section, what I want to do is to look at basically what I call a First Lady's job description. And I've broken down the job of First Lady into six areas. Manager, diplomat, political partner, champion of causes, hostess to a nation, and wife and mother. And I'm just going to touch on this briefly because, as I say, there's an enormous amount of material. But as we talk about these six areas as a job description, I want you to think about three patterns that have emerged in how different women have actually performed in these roles. Some have openly resented the job, and they've never felt comfortable in it, and they've talked about their lack of comfort in this. Second, others have joyfully accepted the role and performed well as hostess and mother. You might say that would be a woman like Mamie Eisenhower, for example. Thirdly, there were those who were more politically active, who used their positions to achieve some social good or political achievement. Of the modern-day First Ladies, Bess Truman and Mamie Eisenhower fit number two, as I said. Eleanor Roosevelt, Lady Bird, Rosalind Carter, Nancy Reagan fall into the third of activism. Jackie Kennedy and Pat Nixon are basically hybrids of all three. Now, first of all, I'll talk about First Lady as manager. The First Lady now presides over a staff of more than 25 people. This all started back in the Teddy Roosevelt administration when Belle Hagner James, who was a clerk in the War Department, this is 1902, was asked to help Edith Roosevelt with her correspondence. From that time to this, the staff grew more or less organically, as I call it, according to the special demands of the time. Belle Hagner became one of the new breed of social secretaries in Washington. But she also briefed members of the press and was, in general, an aide-de-camp. So she was, in essence, the first staff person to a First Lady, Belle Hagner James. But she also acted, in essence, as more than a social secretary. She was generally an aide, and this began to expand. Helen Taft hired several secretaries in succession, but they acted more as clerks. Ellen Wilson brought Belle Hagner back to the White House. Her successor was Edith Helm, who would later serve again, as you know, as many of you may know, under Eleanor Roosevelt. During the Harding and Coolidge administrations, the social office expanded as more and more events were added to the social calendar. Lew Henry Hoover was more interested in her causes and employed her personal secretaries as liaison with these causes. For example, Lew Hoover was chairman of the Girl Scouts. She was an active outdoorsman. She was very involved in what we call today environmental issues. And she began, you see this thread evolving here. She began to use her secretaries and clerks as liaison with these causes. So we're beginning to see the foundations of a modern-day staff for First Lady. Even in the Eleanor Roosevelt era, she depended more on personal assistance and a network of friends than a large staff. You know, this is also an interesting thing. And I think probably not a bad idea when you consider the kind of loyalty that people have had working in this administration. It hasn't run very deep. A lot of these earlier administrations brought in nieces, nephews, aunts, uncles, all kinds of personal retainers and personal friends and relatives to help them actually perform in the job. Because, as I say, it's a multi-person job. But there were several major differences in this is Eleanor Roosevelt's staff. One was the volume of mail Eleanor Roosevelt received. Now, this, again, is the beginning of a new trend here. Remember, she asked the American people to write to her, and they did. Remember in her column, she always said, write to me with your concerns and so forth. And they did write to her by the bagful. Mrs. Roosevelt had reviewed all the previous form letters which first ladies had used, and she had them thrown out. Each letter needed a special reply in that so many of them went into the hardships of the Depression. I mean, you couldn't send a letter to someone who was saying, I have some particular hardship. You couldn't send them a form letter. So what happened was the Depression caused a large increase in Eleanor Roosevelt's staff, largely to answer this mail. Bess Truman and Mamie Eisenhower tried to avoid the subject or responsibility of an organized staff. They wouldn't deal with it. Mamie Eisenhower she related well to domestic staff. She told them exactly what she wanted. And with them, she knew, she told them what she wanted, but she wasn't successful as a manager. Now, here's another weakness. We see this job, this position, developing as a job. But how many first ladies, even today, have come to, and how many presidents, really? I think this is what we see in Ronald Reagan. His lack of experience in management has really exposed one of his real weaknesses, and that is dealing with people, dealing with subordinates, being able to hire and fire people successfully. How many first ladies outside of managing domestic staff have ever had the responsibility of running what I call a small advocacy agency, which is what a first lady's staff has become? Very few of them. Mamie Eisenhower was one. Jacqueline Kennedy had an enormous impact on the establishment of an official staff organization. That was largely because of Tish Baldrige, who she hired as a social secretary and chief of staff. Mrs. Kennedy was the first to hire a press secretary because of the enormous press attention to her clothes, to her activities, to her writing, to her family. There was so much press interest that for the first time, the president's press secretary could not handle all the requests for answers and information. So that was the first administration to have a press secretary. She also used various panels to help, for example, with the renovation of the White House, and she did quite a bit of work with the staff herself. For example, we know that she had card tables set up where she was actually doing work on herself personally with staff on the issue of restoration, not only in the White House, but her interest in Lafayette Square, for example. Lady Bird's appointment of the feisty Liz Carpenter from Texas shifted the chief of staff from social secretary to press secretary. Also, to carry out the beautification program, Lady Bird hired the first program staff. Okay, she got involved in beautification efforts. She knew that she had to have a staff interested and concerned with and following the environmental issues that she was concerned about. Mrs. Carter served as her own chief of staff and appointed her press secretary as East Wing coordinator. She also did a management study of the structure of the East Wing. Today, there's an office of the First Lady. I was the second man to serve as chief of staff. It consists of anywhere, depending on how you count, from 18 to 25 people. It has a budget of several hundred thousand dollars. It has a chief of staff, which coordinates all the activities of the official activities of the First Lady in her life. She has an executive assistant. There is a program director who's responsible for all of the special issues the First Lady's involved with, in this case drug abuse, the foster grandparent program, and at any one time 100 or 200 different organizations that she serves as honorary chairman of. Then there is a press secretary, press office with several people, a social office which manages all the events, about 300 of them that take place in the White House during the year. So you can see it's a very full, oh yes, and a scheduling office, scheduling and advance office. At any one time, we're working 6 months in advance on the First Lady's schedule. So all of those schedule requests that come in have to be handled and dealt with. By the way, the First Lady today receives about 2,000 pieces of mail a month, and they all have to be answered. That is an idea of how the job of First Lady as manager has evolved. Now, secondly, the job of First Lady as diplomat in at home and abroad has evolved from the days when Edith Wilson was the first lady to travel abroad on a diplomatic mission. You know, she went to the signing of the Versailles peace treaty, although there were no women allowed, and she was hoarded into the Hall of Mirrors and was forced to stand behind those enormous red brocade draperies to watch the signing of the treaty. And she wrote later that she was an observer of the peace process, very happy but hot. We saw, and I've done a study in a speech last year, which was called The Impact of First Ladies on World Peace. And in that work, I was able to determine that many First Ladies have been active in both peace movements and what you might call war movements. Many First Ladies during war have gone into the battlefield to nurse soldiers. Many, as I've said, have sold war bonds. Many darned socks, knit pajamas, and all this sort of thing for soldiers. In the early days, for example, the Washingtons had exhibited their own display of what they had to give up as a result of boycotting British products. First Ladies have been traditionally involved in what I would call diplomatic missions, both at home and abroad. You remember that, for example, Pat Nixon traveled to Latin America and to Africa on her own. And at the time she traveled to Africa in a wildly successful tour, it was written by a tribal chief there that she had done more to promote U.S.-African relations than the roaring of a lion. She was very successful. The same on her Latin American trip, both trips which she did solo, by the way. Of course, Eleanor Roosevelt did many solo trips alone, went to the Pacific, went to Britain, and acted as a diplomat in her own meetings with heads of state, conveying messages and her own impressions. In the case of Mrs. Carter, she also made solo trips abroad, some of them more successful than others. Today, we have the First Lady, basically, you say, in what ways can a First Lady act as a diplomat? On these trips abroad, both with her husband and without, she can act to ease tensions between the two leaders. She can help create a responsive atmosphere for a productive atmosphere for meetings, bilateral meetings to be held. And she can entertain visitors graciously and make an impression here in the White House. In the case of Nancy Reagan, in this administration during these 8 years, they've entertained more heads of state than any other president in history. Largely because of the period of time. On her solo trips abroad, including meetings, the first substantial meeting with the Pope on an issue, her travels to Monaco, to Europe, and to Asia, and her meetings in the White House with and at the UN with First Ladies from around the world have gone in to make a more successful foreign policy, stronger communications on a multilateral level and bilateral level with our allies. We can get more into a little bit later about her relationship with Mrs. Gorbachev if you're interested. Thirdly, I would say that this next part of the job description is the more traditional one, and that is as hostess to a nation. First lady, any first lady has tremendous responsibility for setting a tone of the White House. There are about 2 million visitors to the White House every year, some of them invited guests, some of them the public that go through the public rooms of the White House. Dolly Madison was the most successful hostess in Washington during her 16 years. She held public crushes every Wednesday night, where she served whiskey punch and ice cream. She wore outrageously plumed turbans, which became all the rage for that time. She was the star attraction, and she was called every inch a queen. So she was really set the standard for First Lady entertaining. Each First Lady has brought a special kind of flair to entertaining at the White House. Louisa Adams played the harp. Julia Tyler greeted her guests from a throne. We'll talk a little bit more about that. Sarah Polk banned dancing. Abigail Fillmore ordered the first cooking stove in the White House. Conditions were not always what they are today, you know. Sarah Polk, she banned dancing. Lucy Hayes refused to serve liquor. Edith Roosevelt invited famous musicians. Florence Harding used the outside grounds for entertaining the first time. Eleanor Roosevelt, and I think this is interesting, developed a healthy respect. She wrote herself, when she came into the White House, she had little interest in shaking hands, holding teas, and entertaining people. But she began, and I think this is the point I'm trying to make here, she began to see that entertaining in the White House is an opportunity to extend your husband's policies and to project the major points of any political administration to the people. Entertaining on behalf of the White House is simply a people-to-people, person-to-person contact. And that's the responsibility of the First Lady, though the President certainly reflects that as well. It can't be understated, and Eleanor Roosevelt finally came to value that. Jacqueline Kennedy, of course, made her mark as a dramatic hostess. She instituted round tables. For example, the Eisenhowers always had the E-shaped banquet table, which actually I think I prefer today, but the Jacqueline Kennedy instituted the round tables for 10 to be able to facilitate more conversation between people, which is actually very nice. She also invited illustrious guests. Now, today, a First Lady presides over 300 private social events on the state floor a year. And then, of course, the public tours are maintained as well. I won't get into that whole process, but in the case of Nancy Reagan, I was asked yesterday, for example, how much does Nancy Reagan really involve in, for example, a state visit or a state dinner? And I think this has been true of previous First Ladies as well. They're involved in a state visit is planned 6 months in advance of the actual occurrence. So they're involved in forming the guest list, the menus, the tables, the flowers, the tasting the food, actually seating the guests, the entertainment for after dinner. I mean, it's just to manage one of these dinners is an enormous undertaking. The next area is champion of causes. I think of two trends that have promoted this concept of First Lady as a champion of causes. And I've already really mentioned those, and that is the increasing role of women in social work and the American instinct to get involved. You know that very famous quote about Americans forming committees and organizations to address every social problem. Well, this is reflected in the job of First Ladies as well. Ellen Wilson was the first to have her project become legislation, as I mentioned, the Slum Clearance Act. Grace Coolidge volunteered many hours to the Red Cross. Lou Henry Hoover to the Girl Scouts, using radio to mobilize volunteers. Eleanor Roosevelt, you know that wonderful quote that Alice Longworth gave about her, "Never was there a woman who so comforted the distressed and so distressed the comfortable." I love that. Lady Bird Johnson, beautification. Pat Nixon, voluntarism. Betty Ford, women's issues. Rosalind Carter, mental health. Nancy Reagan, you know, drug abuse and so forth. And the reason she got into drug abuse, I think, is probably because she was very comfortable with issues related to the medical community, and as much as her father had been a prominent surgeon in Chicago, and she'd spent a lot of time in hospitals. So through her devotion of her energies to drug abuse, in 1982, we broke up each year with a special emphasis in the area of drugs. In 1982, we focused on young people in treatment centers, and we went around to talk to kids who had burned crosses in their arms and fed drugs to their pets and to their spouses and prostituted themselves to earn money to buy drugs. The next year, we used television as a way to reach out. The First Lady appeared on over 23 television shows, including the, what was it called? It was a sitcom in which she appeared. In fact, there were a couple of them. Then on talk shows, and she also hosted a nationwide program called The Chemical People, which went into organizing community groups. In 1984, we went to national organizations like the Lions and the Kiwanis to mobilize them, and the First Lady spoke to crowds of 30 and 40,000 people. In 1985, we focused on the international dimensions of drug abuse. In 1986, we focused on the effects of drugs on special groups, such as unwed mothers, teenage pregnancies, and so forth. And then, of course, this got involved in the Just Say No program for young people. Now, the next area is political partner. Most First Ladies have been reluctant political partners. They haven't been well prepared, or perhaps many of them have resisted their husband's advances in the political arena. Some early examples of political partnerships, however, include Abigail Adams, Sarah Polk, Mary Lincoln, and Helen Taft. Abigail Adams worked in party politics and was dubbed Mrs. President. Sarah Polk was her husband's closest advisor. Mary Lincoln was especially keen on military personnel, which got her into trouble as well. Now, Nellie Taft, for example, I mean, very few people know this or recognize the fact that she wrote her husband's speeches. She edited her husband's. She was her husband's secretary. Very influential there in terms of her political partner. The more politically active First Ladies of this century, we would say, are Edith Wilson, Eleanor Roosevelt, Betty Ford, Rosalind Carter, and Nancy Reagan. Edith Wilson referred to her period of assisting her husband after his stroke as my stewardship. Others have referred to her as Mrs. President because they think she was much more powerful than she should have been. Eleanor Roosevelt was the most politically active First Lady. She attended government conferences, inspected federal facilities, reviewed legislation, met with cabinet members, union leaders, and congressmen. Now, she even had a government position. She was deputy director of a civil defense agency. My question is, even though those times were extraordinary, would a First Lady pursuing a profile like that be accepted today? And we'll talk about that during the Kitty Dukakis, who I think would probably be a very good First Lady, has said she was going to have an office in the West Wing. Will the American people tolerate this kind of thing? It's going to be very interesting to see. Betty Ford was reluctant at first, but eventually tackled political issues like legalization of marijuana, abortion, and ERA. She personally lobbied representatives of the states for ERA ratification. Rosalind Carter was a thoroughly political partner who had weekly meetings with her husband in the Oval Office. You're familiar with that photograph where they lunched in front of the mantel there. Nancy Reagan, in a way, reacted just in the opposite to this. She saw that Rosalind Carter was blasted for being too involved politically, and she decided that whatever she was going to do, she would not get involved in trying to influence government policy or politics, that her influence on these two areas would be more subtle, and that she would pursue a private course of action. She was not one to get involved in government policy. Now, I can give you some examples later because we're running out of time here. Next, the last area is a wife and mother, which as a, in terms of the job of First Lady, maybe the least important, but in terms of our human capacity to do what needs to be done is probably certainly the most important. Franklin Roosevelt called living in the White House like being on public display. Harry Truman called it living in the Great White Prison. The Reagans have called it living above the store. In any sense, a marriage, a family is put under great stress when they come into the presidency. Whatever it is, it's like living, putting one's family under the microscope of public opinion and living in a fishbowl. This is why so many families, for example, have had vacation homes, and many have escaped to Camp David and so forth. 12 presidents had children of school age living with them at the White House. 16 of them had grandchildren who actually lived at the White House. The Roosevelt's children caught the amusement of a lot of people, though in the case of Eleanor Roosevelt, her own children had to ask for appointments to meet with her, which was certainly not an ideal situation, I don't think. First daughter Margaret Truman caught the public spotlight with her singing. The Eisenhowers had lots of grandchildren. The Kennedy children became celebrities overnight by riding their ponies on the South Lawn and building tree houses. The Ford children held their own press conferences and played out their problems in the national media. The Johnson and Nixon girls were married at the White House. The Carters moved in with the whole family. Then, with the Reagans, nothing. There were no children around. And this caused a great, a lot of consternation on the part of the media because all of a sudden there were no children to focus on. Their family is not untypical of American families. Strained relations. Then what kind of relationship can a First Lady have to her children and to her husband in this marriage situation? It adds up to a great deal of stress and requires an extraordinary ability to do what perform in what I consider to be a job that, though it's much less important, much more complex than being president. That's a summary of the job. Now we're going to go back to those four questions that I promised you, and I'm going to basically open it up for discussion. One, just let me review the questions. How do you eclipse the power of a First Lady? Two, should a First Lady be salaried? Three, should public funds be used to support an office of First Lady? And four, how can we stop trivializing the role of First Ladies? One, how do you eclipse the power of a First Lady? Now, the reason I bring this to your... I'll just make a brief comment. The reason I bring this to your attention is that I see the possibility that a woman could ascend to the job of First Lady and be extraordinarily powerful. There are the means there to know what's going on in classified documents, to know what's going on before it happens, and to be able to influence the course of history, both directly and indirectly. Are there ways? For example, we have a few First Ladies in history, thankfully not more than a few, who have, I think, bordered on abusing power. One was Julia Gardner Tyler, who came to the White House and her first night wrote her mother in New York, "I have arrived at the White House, I've taken quiet possession of the White House, and I have begun my auspicious reign." She sat herself upon a throne-like structure in the East Room of the White House wearing ostrich plumes, bugle beads, and was attended by 12 young virgins dressed in white. And her guests were announced at the door of the East Room, and she was carried around Washington in a coach driven by 12 white horses. Now, you talk about controversial. She was also very powerful. She, like Dolly Madison, they buttonholed members of Congress, pressed their own opinions on them, and lobbied very hard. How do you contain, outside of public opinion, the potential power that a First Lady might have? I mentioned Nellie Taft to you. We talked about every, and I'm not going to even mention Edith Wilson. Mary Todd Lincoln, enormously powerful in moving people around on the military charts. How do we, and do we need to be concerned with controlling or limiting the power of First Lady?
anyone whose wife is out of town who would like to.
Well, first of all, I wonder, in general, why you won, but it would seem to me that now, during the election process, with the media and all, there's quite a bit of exposure of the First Lady, and that if the First Lady misbehaved too badly or was too obnoxious, that this would be noted and would be a very strong negative for her husband in the process of getting elected.
Suppose it were not noted. A lot of what these first ladies have done have been... No, I mean, it's very, very possible for a first lady to conduct herself and be privy to information and use it in a way that the media might never get a hold of it.
Other comments, questions? Yes.
Well, I wonder in your comment of as a president's wife is shell-shocked coming in, is there no definite way that she could be briefed in the interim period between the election and the coming into the White House? Shouldn't there be some kind of book prepared on what she should do or what's recommended that she should do so that she isn't shell-shocked?
Well, I've got one right here for the next first lady. The comment was, can't they be briefed and prepared, the incoming first ladies? How can, and my comment on that is, how can you ever be prepared? You would think that in a way, a lot of these women have had previous political experience, but somehow there's no way to imagine the intensity of the job and the complexity of the job. There's simply not some. I mean, that's why Nancy Reagan had such an awful first year. She had been a governor's wife. She wasn't new to political life, but she came in and she had no idea that she was going to be subject to that kind of scrutiny, and she didn't do a good job of it.
Other comments?
There's one back here.
Dr. Albert.
Mr. Thompson, in his introduction, quoted from Nancy Reagan about words to the effect that the convalescence of a sick president should take precedence over his public affairs role. That sounds very much like the second Mrs. Wilson, who took over not only the convalescence but also the public affairs role. Do you think that this is a serious risk, and if so, do you think that there should be some kind of institutional protection against the mixing of the convalescent role and the public affairs role?
Well, this is a very interesting point. Here is where you come into a blend of public life and private life. The power of a first lady exists in two areas, and that is her perceived power, which is what a lot of Washington is about, and her actual concrete power. A perception of power, an example of which I gave you in that trivial story about the sumo wrestlers, that is a perception of power. You have a lot of people who don't really know whether First Lady has, for example, forced the convalescence period for her husband, who think that a First Lady... So here's perception of power. Then you have the ability of a First Lady to actually influence public policy because, as I put it, she gets the last word at night and the first word in the morning. There's no doubt about that. I mean, she has the potential to be have the strongest influence on the president of anyone, although the president has to listen to cabinet members, members of Congress, public opinion, and certainly his own senior domestic and foreign policy advisors. The influence of Nancy Reagan, for example, history may record as being more pervasive but more subtle. For example, Nancy Reagan's approach was never to say, but she has no interest, for example, in issues like the line item veto of the federal budget process. And yet, She may have an interest in the people who are working on those issues at the Office of Management and Budget, or people who are working for her husband. So in that case, her influence on government may be more subtle, but nonetheless pervasive. In other cases, women may pursue a more direct course to power. My concern here with this question, in a nutshell, and then we'll go on to the next one, is really to say, in the past, we have not had dramatic examples of abuses of power. But it's something that a public policy forum like this should consider could happen. And as this job of being First Lady has become much more public and much more institutionalized, how do we begin to, outside of the press of public opinion and public constraint, begin to say, okay, First Lady, this is as far as you go. You don't go any further. Next, should First Ladies be salaried?
Where did their funds come from?
They have no funds. Well, they have the budget for several hundred thousand dollars comes out of the Office of Administration called OA Budget for the President. It was enacted, it was formalized during the Carter years as the Office of First Lady Budget under the office by a Congressional Act 581A or something like that. But that was the first time that it was ever institutionalized. Before that, funds were simply granted on a forgiving basis from the President's Office of Administration to the First Lady staff. Now it's institutionalized. But the First Lady, of course, herself receives no reimbursement outside of travel. Now, people even ask me, well, are there funds given to Mrs. Reagan for clothing allowance and so forth? Nothing, you know. I mean, people do think that. Should a First Lady be salaried?
There are parallels, aren't there? The resident head of the Rockefeller Foundation Conference Center, the Villa Serbelloni, is not only paid, but his wife is paid. And this came about because Bill, in that area, that she insisted on being salaried. So there are some precedents. But not in the vortex of politics, probably.
Well, of course, there is an example. The wives of Foreign Service officers have made a campaign, though only partly successful, to be paid. I mean, you know, the wife of, perhaps there's some here in this room, but the wives of U.S. ambassadors when serving abroad work, you know, easily a full-time job. It's easily a full-time job. And they've campaigned to be recognized and to be paid for what they do as well.
What do the ladies think?
Well, I'm wondering, can Mrs. Reagan travels abroad, like going to the weddings, royal weddings, is that at her personal expense or their personal expense? Or it seems to me that she's serving in the capacity of a government official. And her expenses certainly
are
paid.
Her expenses are paid.
This is salary on top of that.
Yes. Well, do you think when we have a first gentleman, when we have a lady president, that this might change, that you will demand to be paid?
Well, I would say this, that when we have the first man serving, as I'm sure that we will, they're going to have to come to grips with the fact that there are simply many, many jobs to be done here as a spouse of the head of state. And those jobs are going to have to be done by someone. They're really what the State Department calls representational roles. And I think that the only example we have that comes anywhere close is Dennis Thatcher. And Dennis Thatcher refuses to be to work in that representational capacity. He does not represent the Prime Minister. He does not entertain. He does not. He's not a social crusading spouse. He is a totally private individual whose spouse happens to be Prime Minister. Now, this job is so up for grabs that you could have someone come in and, you know, be a Dennis Thatcher, or you could have something different.
When Ann Armstrong was ambassador to Port of St. James, and her husband insisted that he have some sort of a job, so one was created for him in the embassy. I can see why he couldn't sit there. So it was created.
That's interesting.
It was a bit of a...
Other questions?
Carol? I think it would be very hard to, because of the amount of activity you would get from First Lady and engage her, very small. If you put her on a salary, she might be expected to do things she had no interest in doing. What about just giving her an honorarium now and then for a speech?
With this large budget which the First Lady has for the running of the household affairs, does she find difficulty living with it? And does she have to make periodic applications for an increase when the staff is added to the already existing staff?
No, it's ample.
Other questions?
Yeah. Mrs. Raven's clothes. She's such a very good advertisement for her designer. Does she have to pay for all her clothes, or do they contribute some? And you very seldom see her in the same outfit. Does she donate any of her clothes to charity or whatever?
Well, you see, there are public regulations. The question is about Mrs. Reagan's clothes. There are public regulations that prohibit the President and First Lady from accept all public officials from accepting any gift worth more than $165. I can tell you many gold watches that I got from leaders in the Middle East, and you can see I'm not wearing a gold watch today. They all went back to the GSA. Anything over $165 goes into and has to be auctioned off. So they can't accept anything like that, and I think that's probably a very good regulation. The third, shall we go on to the third question, is should public funds be used to support the office of First Lady? You're just beginning to touch upon that, but in the case, for example, of I know Mrs. Reagan's recent travel to Scandinavia, the question began to surface, do the American taxpayers want to pay for a First Lady to be a globe-trotting diplomat? She's not elected. It accrues to the benefit of taxpayers, but do we want to pay for that? Why is it all of a sudden, you know, we have a budget of several hundred thousand dollars for First Lady?
Ambassadors and other diplomats are not elected either. They're appointed by the President. So I would suggest it all depends on how able the First Lady is in this capacity. I resent paying for a lousy ambassador, too.
Any other comments?
Well, in that connection, was she invited by the company to come as First Lady?
Yes.
Oh. And I think we should pay for her if she's going there to represent us. And she would have probably invited if she wanted to be sure.
I think the President's salary should be increased to include provisions for things that would accomplish the role of an ambassador. Rather than, it seems to me that if we put too much in the budget for the First Lady, is in conflict to what the President was elected for, in a way. So that's the way I feel.
Okay, lastly, how can we stop trivializing the role of First Ladies? This is something that's been a particular concern to me. For example, when Mrs. Reagan and Mrs. Gorbachev are standing talking and the media shouts questions to them like, is it true that you really hate each other or you can't get along? Or how can this role that I described to you as a very important, serious role be taken that way by the public?
Start with
the press.
Work on the media.
There's that coming.
Yes, back in the...
From on the porch.
I think one of the ways you can stop trivializing is probably discipline the press, for one. For two, probably if you don't give her credibility, you're not going to stop trivializing her power or her position. You've got to give her some funding. You've got to give her some status. And in order to do that, we're going to have to change our approach. Not sneak her salary in with her husband's, but to give her her own position and her own credibility. Then the trivializing will automatically disappear.
Claire?
You run into the one who does not want to have anything to do with it. So that is the salary of the one who says that she doesn't want to be involved politically.
Yes. Great.
It seems to me that would add a new factor to the whole nominating process for the president. Are we going to start then trying to choose not only a man to be president, but a specific kind of lady to be the first lady? I think it begins to change that whole process when you think of electing two people instead of just one.
Yes.
Well, I think that when you don't see the value that a partner has, that a lifelong partner, we usually elect people who have been married for a long time. And I think of Mrs. Schultz, who goes nearly everywhere with her husband, and her value is immeasurable by just being there. And I see the role of the First Lady as being invaluable by just giving the President a normal, at least a partially normal life. She lessens the strain, she lessens the hassles, and I just think she's valuable as she is. I don't know why all these little things have to come into it. I think it reflects not her, but the people who are looking at it.
Well, I think in truth it does reflect the fact that today we are interested in substantial issues, but in every walk of life, there's an absorbing interest in personality worship, and the details of people who are public figures, whether they be from the entertainment industry or whether they be from the political world. We want to know what their lives are like, what their relationships are like, how much money they're making, where they're going, what they're saying, all the nuances. And certainly anyone who comes into this job of President and First Lady is subject to that. You've been a wonderful audience, and I'm going to go through the room and stand by the table in case any of you would like a book. Sure.